Accession number 10044, Reel 4.
Mr. Powell, Reel 4.
There was, of course, a General Staff Officer Grade 3 for Chemical Warfare, and it's a significant fact that at that stage in the war there was such a separate appointment in the establishment of a headquarters of an armoured division. However, in effect, I found myself doing general staff work, the equipment of units, the delivery of tanks to units, the equipment of units, the drawing up of exercises, the execution of exercises, all that general staff work, though I was at a low level, did come my way. And I found that I learnt a great deal about staff work and about the inbuilt efficiency of the army's methods, which I was obliged gradually to acquire in the 6 months that I was with the headquarters of 9th Armoured Division. I also, which was to be relevant later, made many friends in the cavalry regiments, which were in the 9th Armoured Division. And when subsequently I got myself transferred out of a general list, which I never wanted to belong to, who would? My first attempt was to get into the 5th Royal Inniskilling Dragoon Guards, as I had known them, in 9th Armoured Division. In the end, I settled for the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and very happily ever afterwards. But it was 6 months of intensive training in an aspect of military organisation which was quite strange to me, and from which I learnt quickly and deeply. It was from there that, thanks to the general putting my name forward, I was posted to the 5th War course at Camberley, the 5th War Staff course at Camberley. And I certainly owe a great deal to the general officer for having given me that opportunity at that stage in my service. The bombing of Coventry took place a few miles away from 9th Armoured Division, and the interruption of the manufacture of war material, and particularly of armoured vehicles, was very noticeable. The formation of a division was certainly held up quite substantially by the destruction brought about in the bombing of Coventry. I remember the glow in the sky just over the horizon from Northamptonshire. I was also in the headquarters of that armoured division, seeing something at close by of the ordinary work of a regimental officer. And I remember a strange episode in which a trooper in the headquarters unit had been accused of theft and asked that I should defend him at court-martial. And to this day, I'm puzzled why I failed to get him off. He evidently thought that, as I'd been a professor and had some reputation for intellectual capability, that I would be a good advocate. But I imagine that probably the officers knew what they were doing, and that I was firing into the void. That's one little experience that remains with me from those months with 9th Armoured Division. The Staff College, I regard still as the most valuable 4 months training and education I ever had in my life. It disappointed me initially when I discovered that it was primarily to be concerned with staff duties at brigade and divisional level. For saturated with Clausewitz and the art of war, I had imagined that it's at Staff College at last, the movements of armies and army groups would be among the subjects which we should study. There were two officers, two French officers, on the same course, who had escaped at the fall of France, with one of whom I remained close friend until he died a few years ago. And we did have the sort of conversation at Camberley that I had imagined one would have at a military staff college. So we were derisively described as the strategists.
Can you remember his name?
De Gogouin was the name of a man who, with whom I remained friendly. He was from La Rochelle and was of a Huguenot family. De Vaugoin, D-E-V-A-U-G-O-I-N. De Vaugoin. However, the staff work at brigade and divisional level, as it was taught at the staff college, certainly gave me rules of conduct in the dispatch of business and habits of precision and exactitude which I have used for the rest of my life and for which I've always been grateful. The proposition that everything must always be described in the same way, that a description must be unambiguous, that a message must be capable of containing all the necessary information and nothing else, and of being understood under conditions of great haste and distress. All these lessons were inculcated and inculcated successfully by the four-month staff course at Camberley. I also learnt to appreciate the instructive value of the TOOT, a tactical exercise without troops, which we also construed as a tedious exercise without termination. The extent to which officers could be trained and military thinking could be stimulated by moving around the country with maps and imaginary armies was, of course, pioneered by the German General Staff Corps on their Generalstabsritt, as they used to call it. But it was certainly a most effective method of concentrating the mind in a manner which on ordinary exercises, conventional exercises, would have been impossible, on the type of decision and the predicament with which staff officers would have to cope. And I have no hesitation, taking it all in all, in commending, in giving high commendation to the quality of the instruction with which I was turned out with an SC, subsequently in egalitarian days commuted to a PSC with the removal of the dagger which had originally indicated that it was only war service. On passing out, and that does not signify passing out in a peacetime sense, from that staff course, I had hoped that I would be posted to an armored division again. And I went to and beyond the limits of insubordination in the endeavor to attain that objective when I learnt that I was to be sent out to the headquarters Middle East in an intelligence staff job, to my disgust, and what's more, sent out in the rank of captain instead of major, as my which would be the rank to which most of my fellow students would, most of my fellow students would be reappointed. However, to Cairo I was posted in October 1941, after arriving immediately after the failure of Operation Crusader and the stabilization of the opposing forces at Halfaya. I had my closest lifelong friend, who was before the war a traffic apprentice with the London Midland and Scottish Railway, had before the war joined the supplementary reserve of officers as a transportation and railway expert, and was as such commissioned in the Royal Engineers and called up before the actual outbreak of war. We never met again until I was with 9th Armoured Division, and then resumed our usual relationship. But he disappeared from my ken in the summer of 1941. When I landed by flying boat on the Nile on my arrival in Egypt, he met me at the landing stage, having noticed my name in the list of passengers and thinking it part of his duty as staff captain transportation to confirm my arrival. My arrival perhaps needed confirmation. A number of officers were sent out to the Middle East in October by an extraordinary route. We were flown to Shannon. From Shannon we were flown to Lisbon. From Lisbon we were flown to Malta. And on from Malta to Alexandria. To Cairo. So I was with the familiar Imperial Airways flying boats again, in their wartime guise. But since we were going through neutral countries, we were sent out as civilians, and each of us was provided with a civilian passport for the purpose, though our uniforms were carefully packed in our suitcases. At Shannon, we went through an interrogation, by the immigration officer, customs officer, no doubt, who, rather to my discomfiture, said, "I see you're a civil servant. What department are you in?" Now, I hadn't thought that one out. He saw my hesitation. He said, "I mean, are you in the Treasury?" So I said, "Yes, I'm in the Treasury, of course." He said, "Mr. So-and-so, who's just gone through." I said, "Yes, we're travelling out together." So I immediately, after emerging, buttonholed this individual and said, "Look, I gather you told them you're in the Treasury. I said I'm with you and that I'm in the Treasury too. I thought you'd better know, so we'll stick to the same story, shall we?" So he said, "But I am in the Treasury." I said, "Now look, you don't need to do that. We're all officers here. What regiment are you in?" "I'm Royal Warwick. This gentleman here is in the Royal Navy." He said, "But I am in the Treasury." And for a long time he was unable to convince us that he really was a civil servant. He was quite indignant about it. The other incidents I remember in that transit were being in a hotel in Lisbon with Germans at the next table in a brightly illuminated Lisbon. And the final event was in taking off from beleaguered Malta. The flying boats had a limited tolerance of wave height, and we took a chance in taking off. And when we turned back, the captain observed that one more of those and we would have been stove in. So it perhaps wasn't entirely superfluous for my friend Captain Curtis, Staff Officer Transport, to make it part of his duty to greet me on my arrival in Cairo. I found that I was to work with a Colonel C.M. Keeble, who afterwards became known to history for his part in the affairs of Yugoslavia, in Yugoslavia, in 1944-1945. Lieutenant Colonel C.M. Keeble, Wiltshire Regiment. He had been an instructor on the intelligence course at Swanage a year before, and had apparently asked for me to be posted out to his section. I should have mentioned that when on the intelligence course in Swanage, I wrote an appreciation. and offered it to my superior officers. It was an appreciation in which I argued, I thought convincingly, that we could only win the war if Russia came in, that only Russia could provide the continental manpower and the continental pressure which would make it possible for Germany to be defeated. And I understood afterwards that considerable inquiries had been made as to my political background to discover how an officer can have such extraordinary ideas about the essential function of Russia in August 1940, a time when certainly Russia seemed a long way off. I'm not sure that that exactly was what commended me to Colonel Keble. Anyhow, I was given my assignment. I was to familiarize myself with the transport organization of the German army in the Middle East, and also with the movement capabilities of the German army in various circumstances, such as an attempt to enter the Middle East from the north through Turkey or through Persia. Because by now, the invasion of Russia occurred while I was still at Staff College. In June, did it not? 1941.
Yes.
I remember I was visiting a young cavalryman whom I had met on these intelligence courses and who had become intelligence officer to 9th Armored Division. And we kept in touch. And he was in the military hospital for something in Hatfield House. Now, I remember on my previous visit to see him, on the 16th, which was my birthday, he had given me the works of Pushkin in Russian. And then on the 23rd, my next visit a week later, we were confronted with the fact of the invasion of Russia and the provision of that factor in a British victory by which I'd been dominated from the outset in 1939.
So you must have been delighted then when you heard that Hitler had invaded Russia.
It was like coming out of darkness into light.
But how did you react when, in the early months, Russia looked as though she was defeated?
Well, 1812, I suppose, is as firmly lodged, almost as firmly lodged as 1588 in the folk memory of the English. And I suppose that just as we had thought in 1940, that when the British stage a major retreat and leave the continent, they are laying the foundations of victory. I suppose one supposed that the Russians always got themselves thoroughly defeated and withdrew into the heart of Russia as a preliminary to inflicting an irreversible reverse upon the dominant power on the European continent. So I cannot remember registering dismay, though I was very much aware of Stalingrad in the winter of 1941, 42-43. So I set to work with the intelligence material with which I was provided, and I made myself acquainted with the logistics of moving armored divisions from the Bulgarian frontier to Syria, and also with the logistics of movement in Iraq and Persia. I considered at that stage that my duty to the war effort was to manipulate the German capability. Now, in any calculation of movement capabilities for a large armed forces, there is a huge latitude for the variables which enter into the calculation, particularly where so little of the railway system has been surveyed for military purposes, as had the Turkish railway system. And according to the assumptions which one makes, one can arrive at strikingly different capabilities of movement and arrival at a point. The worst the campaign went in North Africa, with which I was not directly concerned, except that I examined a good deal of German captured material bearing upon the supply position. The worse the battle went in North Africa, the more slowly the German high command would have succeeded in penetrating Turkey. One's heart would have bled for the difficulties which the Germans would have encountered in invading Turkey and opening a second front in the Middle East. As things got better, however, the prospects which I produced for the German movements correspondingly improved, and their arrival dates and their number of divisions on a line at a given D plus date improved substantially, which even shows how in a humble position low down in an intelligence organization there is an input which can affect the morale of the high command, or at any rate which was intended to affect the morale of the high command. My view being that I don't want the high command distracted from the main effort in North Africa, so I'll do my little bit to ensure that they're not distracted. I'm sure this is a confession which an intelligence officer ought not to be making. So I'll proceed to my next confession, which is more cheerful. There came a time when I had gained the confidence of senior officers sufficiently by my work in this unit, which as a cover was called MI Plans, to be brought into use, into direct use, of the ultra material which lay behind so many of the bogus intelligence reports, of the intelligence reports credited to espionage, which had previously come across my desk. And I remember very vividly the day when I was introduced to Uncle Henry. For Uncle Henry was the pet name by which ultra went in the Middle East amongst those who were on the list for using it. It derives from a passage in Jerome K. Jerome where the phrase occurs, "You should always believe what your Uncle Henry tells you." And we nearly always did believe what our Uncle Henry told us. And he told us, of course, as everyone nowadays knows, the most significant and important things. In particular, he told us facts which enabled the German supply position in North Africa to be calculated probably more accurately than it was known to Rommel himself, or certainly as accurately as it was known. The cargoes, the places of arrival, the capacity of the ships, the ammunition state, the transportation difficulties. These became part of a picture which I was still theoretically only concerned with outside the field in North Africa. However, I was seeing the material. And in January 1942, advice was tendered to the Commander-in-Chief by the Director of Military Intelligence that German Mark II tanks were the heaviest armour likely to be encountered, and that 5th Light, which had become 5th Armoured and was Rommel's main armoured unit, was not equipped with armour above Mark II. Now this information, which one should never say caused, but was a contributory cause to the underestimate which was so dangerous and nearly fatal in North Africa of German armoured capabilities, actually arose in the room which where I worked, because Long Range Desert Group, with whom I was subsequently to spend a few weeks carrying out a reconnaissance of the Katara Depression to determine whether a flanking move could be carried out by German armour through the Katara Depression so as to turn the line at Alamein. That remarkable outfit, Long Range Desert Group, had maintained a dawn to dusk visual survey of the North Africa Road east of El Agheila, and had reported back the numbers and types of all vehicles passing in both directions. They maintained this watch from a position which incredibly was never observed, not much more than 100 yards away from the road, where they lay up after having arrived by crawling, protected by undulations in the desert, and they lay up for hours just counting and eventually being relieved and reporting back. They described vehicles which appeared to be German tanks Mark III and Mark IV, but the possibility that Mark IV tanks could be moving, I said east when I meant west, west of El Agheila, the German Mark IV tanks could be moving east in North Africa was discounted because there were known to be no derricks at Tripoli which could handle the weight of Mark IV tanks, nor could ships' derricks handle Mark IV tanks. The report was therefore discounted, and the build-up of heavy armour in Rommel's force in the early months, the early weeks of 1942, was written down by the intelligence advice to the High Command and to Eighth Army. There was a gap in the reasoning. The reasoning was faulty because it composed information of different qualities. It combined information. We had information of high quality from Ultra, which certainly did not specify cargoes comprising Mark III and Mark IV tanks. We had information visually, but subject to the qualifications of visual information, from the Long Range Desert Group. And we had knowledge, which was of a different quality, of the capability of the available cranes or derricks. Now, it so happened that in the 1930s, in order to facilitate the export of very heavy locomotives to South America, Germany had built two ships, the Leverkusen and the Ankara, which were capable of handling loads of 900 tons with their derricks. Those ships had been moved to the Mediterranean. The Leverkusen was sunk at an early stage, but the Ankara had a kind of charmed life. And the Ankara was carrying Marks 3 and 4 tanks into Tripoli.